My name is Michael McCusker. I'd like to read something that was just sent care of me here about Occupy Astoria from Lee Miller. It's a list of specific demands for Congress. He says here that he and I discussed the Occupy Wall Street movement and that corporate-owned media portray it as nebulous and without definition. He said, this is far from the truth, and here is a list of those specific demands for Congress. 1. Pass H.R. 1489, and that's in the House, Return to Prudent Banking Act. Returns the firewall between investment banking and commercial banks, which is what the Glass-Steagall Act had been after the first Big Depression. The deregulation of this conflict of interest has caused the economic meltdown from which the nation still suffers. 2. Use congressional authority and oversight to ensure appropriate federal agencies fully investigate and prosecute Wall Street criminals. In the face of the biggest frauds in American history, not a single greedy villain has been heavily fined and sent to prison. 3. Enact legislation to protect our democracy by reversing the effects of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. Corporations can now secretly spend unlimited amounts of money to buy any election. The legislation should also revive the fairness doctrine in all media. Candidates should be given equal time for free at reasonable intervals in daily programming during election season. 4. Pass the Buffett rule on fair taxation so that the rich and corporations pay their fair share and close corporate tax loopholes. Enact prohibition on hiding funds offshore. Include harsh penalties. 5. Completely revamp the Securities and Exchange Commission. Give it the expertise, manpower, and teeth to protect the integrity of the market as it was originally designed to work. 6. Pass specific and effective laws limiting the influence of lobbyists and eliminating the practice of lobbyists writing legislation that ends up on the floor of Congress. 7. Pass revolving door legislation, eliminating the ability of former government regulators going to work for corporations they once regulated. 8. Eliminate personhood, legal status for corporations. And as Lee writes, this list of demands puts the lie to the false, disparate, indignant accusations of some extreme libertarians, Republicans, teabaggers, and other corporate stooges. Unlike the propaganda being foisted upon the American public by corporately owned media, the movement is well thought out and specific in its goals. It consists of people of all ages and beliefs. And that was from Lee Miller here in Astoria. Well, there was a meeting last Thursday, or a sort of a seminar, you might say, at the Harvard on the Hill, otherwise known as Clatsop Community College. And among them was this letter written by Richard Heinberg, senior fellow Post-Carbon Institute, a letter he sort of addresses to all of the Occupy movements in the country. And it was read by one of the teachers at the seminar, one of the profs. And I have a copy of it, and I'd like to read it now. And this is by Richard Heinberg. Here's a fact that's hard for most Americans to swallow. Economic growth is over. Given the finite, however you want to pronounce it, nature of our planet and its resources, the recent trend of global economic expansion was destined to end. No stimulus package or slashing of social programs is going to flip the economy back to an expansionary trajectory. We have hit the proverbial wall, and this will be the defining reality of our lives from now on. The growth-seeking political economic system has failed us. Today, that system is dominated by Wall Street. Goldman Sachs rules the world. Trader Alessio Rastani told us in a now viral BBC interview. I met people like Rastani in researching my book, The End of Growth. At one lavish conference, 800 global investors packed a hotel ballroom to consider climate change. There was no talk of how to avert or mitigate floods and droughts. Instead, the discussion focused on profiting from warming with, and this is no joke, weather derivatives. These folks were just doing their job, despite any private feelings of concern, remorse, or dread, and each was getting paid enough to single-handedly fund a mid-sized school district. Both Wall Street and Washington are trying to do something impossible: grow human consumption forever in a world of limited energy, minerals, water, topsoil, and biodiversity, all while protecting and expanding the riches of the top 1%. If economic growth is over, that means we can no longer count on a rising tide to lift all boats. Under these conditions, extreme income inequality is not just unfair, it is socially unsustainable. It is strategic to bring protests to Wall Street rather than Washington. We must go directly to the crime scene, not with the request for reforms, but with an arrest warrant from the people. You courageous people in the Occupy movement, and that is everybody all over the country and all over the world he's addressing this to, are absolutely right in saying the system is broken, greedy, and unfair. But when our discussion turns to replacing the current system, we've got to embrace a bigger view of reality than the one held by stock traders and politicians. It's not just our wealth they want to control, it's our vision for what is both possible and necessary. We need a post-growth economy that works both for people, all of them, and for the rest of nature, a localized economy based on renewable resources harvested at nature's rates of replenishment, not a fossil-fueled global economy driven by the imperative of ever higher returns on investment. There will be life after growth, and it can be a better life if our nation's priority is the quality of life of our people and the integrity of the biosphere rather than stock prices and corporate profits. And he signs off with support, Richard Heinberg, Senior Fellow, Post Carbon Institute, and also the author of The End of Growth. Reminds me of René Dubos, however you want to pronounce his name, D-U-O-B-O-S, who years and years ago said the now very famous, think globally, act locally. Now I'd like to read an article that appeared in the May 2011 In These Times that a friend of mine dropped off the other day. And it is before the Occupy movement started, but he's calling forth for just such a thing to occur. And it's called Take the Fight to the Streets by Stephen Lerner. To build a just society, we must make America's plutocrats very, very uncomfortable. This can be our moment. A new activism is emerging in the United States and abroad, where people in unexpected places are standing up to challenge the rich and powerful. From recent uprisings in Egypt to young people and workers in Europe marching and striking against short-sighted austerity plans, to the battle of nurses, teachers, firefighters, and community members in Wisconsin, and the sit-ins and occupations of banks starting around the country, a movement is starting to grow. After being battered and on the defensive, we have an opportunity in the United States to go on the offensive to transform the economy and politics of our country and create shared prosperity for all. Corporations have $1.6 trillion in cash reserves and are making record profits. The CEOs of Wall Street and the big banks paid themselves record compensation and bonuses of $135 billion in 2010, $7 billion more than in 2009. After trillions of dollars in bailouts, they are even bigger and more dominant than before the economic crash. Now can be our moment to build a movement that both captures the popular imagination and has a strategy to engage millions of people to improve their lives by harnessing One, the potential power of government to force banks to pay their fair share of taxes and renegotiate toxic interest rates that are sucking billions out of city and state budgets. Two, the potential power of homeowners and students to renegotiate unfair mortgages and loans, keeping millions in their homes and putting billions into the economy to create jobs. Three, the potential power of public employee unions to bargain and demand that government implements concrete proposals that would save billions by holding Wall Street and banks accountable. And four, the potential power of private sector unions to organize and bargain not just for existing union members, but also to fix broken industries and to alter business practices that exploit communities and pollute the environment. To do this, we need to understand how our country and our economy got in the mess they are in, the opportunities we have missed over the last 2 years, and the critical role we can all start playing to fix it. In an ironic twist of history, the same people responsible for the global financial and economic meltdown are using a crisis of their own making to amass wealth and power in concentrations not seen since the beginning of the 20th century. We are experiencing a corporate counter-revolution, the goal of which is to reverse the arc of the last 100 years, to undo the historic gains that built up the middle class and secured greater equality, freedom, and economic, racial, and social justice. It is not a surprise that corporate CEOs would organize and fight ferociously to defend their interests and expand their privileges. What is shocking is how we progressives blew an opportunity in 2008, when the moral bankruptcy of the super rich and the failure of the free market, and that's in quotes, ideology were exposed to challenge growing economic inequality and the power of Wall Street elites. Seduced by our new access, and that's also in quotes, to the White House, we were trapped in an inside-the-beltway political game at the very moment we should have been organizing, marching, sitting in, and confronting the corporations that crashed the economy. While millions lost their jobs, homes, and the savings accumulated during a lifetime of work, with communities of color and immigrants particularly hard hit, we crowed about newfound political power and influence. And now we complain about inaction by politicians, the devastating losses in the 2010 elections, and why we can't seem to connect with the American people on issues we should be winning on. To develop a plan of action that rises to the complex perils and opportunities we face, we need to understand what has been happening. Capitalism, and our entire democracy, is being reorganized in a way that maximizes profits for the wealthiest few, but ultimately shrinks the middle class. Corporate CEOs control politics and politicians to such an extent that we are unable to make the legislative changes needed to reverse this. Wall Street, big banks, multinational corporations, and the super rich were able to seize the opportunity in 2008. They are now in the extraordinary position of leveraging the insecurity most Americans face to demand unending concessions, while simultaneously demanding security and certainty for their own capital and investments. Events unfolding in state houses in Wisconsin, Ohio, and around the country demonstrate that Wall Street, giant corporations, the super rich, and the politicians they support are ruthlessly executing a plan to slash public budgets, destroy public employee unions, and the livelihoods of teachers, nurses, firefighters, and other civil servants, privatize public utilities, roads, schools, hospitals, and prisons, permanently cut social programs and benefits, and, all the while, radically reduce their own taxes. But this is just the first step in the corporate elite's campaign to eliminate the remaining islands of private sector union strength and slash benefits and pay for all workers. Corporations and the rich no longer think they need an American middle class with decent paying jobs to be profitable. Corporate profits can now be earned from a growing global consumer class, while at the same time mass unemployment and declining living standards become the new normal. The United States is important to the corporate elites as a safe haven, but they no longer see a decent living standard for the majority of Americans as important to their economic success. In order to further its goals, the right has successfully created a narrative in which big government, unions, and public employees are bankrupting the country and killing jobs. And that's a quote. We need to shift that narrative to Wall Street multinational corporations and the super rich are bankrupting governments and communities, shipping away jobs, foreclosing our homes, destroying the middle class, and threatening our children's future. And that is also a quote. Until we break this corporate stranglehold, we will have no money to solve state budget crises. Given the scads of money that corporate interests pump into politics, without a demand from the streets, politicians think that they cannot champion policies that would hurt their friends. And that's a quote. In state after state, Democrats will make massive cuts to services and public employee jobs like their Republican counterparts. They just won't demand an end to collective bargaining on top of it. And absent a strategy of escalating and dramatic actions that expose the wrongdoing of corporations and the uber-rich that got us into this mess, we are trapped in a strategy that depends on politicians to rein in the very corporations they are enthralled to. Corporations are creating an environment that is favorable to them, but harmful to most Americans. Our job is to figure out how to turn this scenario on its head, to decrease their security so we can win greater opportunity and security for the rest of us, lifting the bottom, growing the middle, and holding the top in check, just as we did for most of the 20th century. Creating massive insecurity for Wall Street corporations and the super rich is a precondition for fixing the economy and country. There can be no new social contract, no new New Deal, no comprehensive legislation that allows workers to organize, and no limits to corporate power as long as corporate CEOs feel insulated from the suffering they cause. At first blush, this sounds a little crazy. It runs counter to the message many economists and politicians bombard us with every day in the media. Their claim is that businesses aren't investing, jobs aren't being created, and the housing market isn't stabilizing because the corporate community needs greater certainty and predictability. These same people would argue that Obama and the Democrats need to be more business-friendly. Yet, corporate America already has record profits and cash on hand. In short, the best of all worlds. They know far better than we do that their hold on power is dependent on our acquiescence to their false premises and pseudo-free market ideology. Therefore, we must directly challenge them in the streets so that they have more to lose by ignoring the public interest than by accepting real change. I know many Americans are cynical about the possibility of the success of such an effort in the United States. But we have a long and proud tradition of challenging the economic and political interests of the powerful through direct action. Far from being alien to the American experience, it is central to the founding mythology of the country. Ironically, the Tea Partiers named themselves after one of the earliest acts of civil disobedience, the Boston Tea Party. Resistance to injustice is as American as apple pie. From the populist movement of the late 19th century, to the bonus marches after World War I, to the factory occupations of the 1930s, to the civil rights, student, anti-war, women's, and environmental movements born in the 1960s, to the lesbian, gay, LGBT rights, immigration rights, and anti-globalization movements. In more recent years, we have a long history of direct action in mass movements that at certain moments capture the imagination of the country and lead to fundamental change. And at no time since the Great Depression have so many people become disconnected from the promise of the American dream. Millions of people are losing their homes or are trapped in upside-down, underwater mortgages. Students have close to $1 trillion in debt from student loans. Their schools' budgets are being cut, and they have few job options upon graduation. Millions of public sector workers are at risk of losing their jobs, benefits, and pensions. African Americans have been stripped of wealth accumulated over generations through subprime loans and declining housing values. The majority of white, non-college educated workers believe that the standard of living for them and their children will be worse in the future. Latinos and other immigrants have seen hopes of immigration reform dashed. The list of those increasingly left behind by the reorganization of the economy goes on and on. The same is true for many organizations and movements. As a result of the Citizens United decision, groups that have worked for years for electoral and political change are now confronting defeat. So too are environmentalist and anti-climate change groups that have been stymied in trying to pass legislation that just a few short years ago seemed a near certainty. Organizations that have focused on state budgets and public services are under siege in state after state. There isn't a shortage of people, constituencies, or groups for whom the system no longer works. So the question is, how do we encourage, spark, magnify, and grow the number of people, groups, and places where people are standing up for our communities and our future? A new kind of mass movement is now possible because of the speed and variety of communications. The internet and social media not only offer an opportunity to communicate, organize, and mobilize in new and creative ways, but they are uniquely designed to support efforts to destabilize and create uncertainties for elites. The exciting part is figuring out how to combine online activity with offline traditional organizing so that they magnify each other's impact. Anonymous, and that's in quotes, has already demonstrated how a cyber action can prevent a major corporation from engaging in business as usual while trampling on the public interest, in the same way a factory occupation stops production until a company negotiates fairly with its workers. We have more potential, people, organizations, and tools to stand for economic justice than we have had at any time in recent history. Labor, civil rights, and other groups that are involved in building a progressive majority and infrastructure are important, but they can't lead such a campaign alone. These groups are essential to funding and to creating capacity, credibility, and scale. But the reality is that these important institutions have just enough political access, financial assets, and institutional interest to hinder and ultimately strangle a campaign of mass resistance strong enough to force fundamental changes in how the economy is organized. In order to succeed, the campaign can't be held in check by these institutions with too much to lose. Unions with hundreds of millions in assets and collective bargaining agreements covering millions of workers won't risk their treasuries and contracts by engaging in large-scale sit-ins, occupations, and nonviolent civil disobedience, then inevitably must overcome court injunctions and political pressure in order to succeed. The same is true for many progressive and civil rights groups that receive significant funding from corporations. Electorally focused groups have worked too hard to risk losing political access. These aren't criticisms. They are a reality. Groups that were built for traditional electoral politics, lobbying, and collective bargaining can't turn themselves, nor should they, into instruments of direct action challenging the status quo. And when we look back in history from the New Deal to the civil rights movement to the immigrant and gay rights movements today, we find again and again that a vibrant, independent activist flank is a prerequisite for transformative change. There isn't a simple one-size-fits-all answer to the question of who can help build and lead this. It won't happen spontaneously, nor will it happen through traditional coalition work. In Madison, the work of the teaching assistants and students was a critical piece of launching, sustaining, and expanding the campaign. Along with community groups, they led the occupation of the Capitol, which helped define and propel the campaign forward. In other cities, existing and emerging community-based organizing groups, newly activated students and people and organizations steeped in nonviolent direct action can add energy, creativity, and nimbleness to more traditional organizations and protests. One part of the answer may be to integrate and directly connect union members with independent groups and people so that the campaign can't be easily turned off because of legal or political pressure. The cliche, from Roosevelt to Johnson to Obama, is true. We need to make them, and that's in quotes, do the right thing. It can't be done without the support of the labor movement and the progressive infrastructure. But rather than imagining a unified campaign spearheaded by traditional institutions, we need to think about overlapping but independent campaigns focused on challenging the power of Wall Street and out-of-control corporate power. To go on offense and win real changes in how the economy and politics of the country are organized, we need to follow three steps. The first step is to connect the central role that Wall Street, big banks, and the super rich played in breaking our economy to concentrate demands that we can fight for, demands that are not dependent on passing federal legislation. We need state and local campaigns that can mobilize around winnable issues. We need to put ourselves on the moral high ground, name the bad guys, and offer solutions by showing how the hundreds of billions of dollars that corporations are hoarding could be put to work fixing the economy. Wall Street is bankrupting cities, states, homeowners, and students with trillions of dollars in unfair debt, even after the big banks received $17 trillion in bailouts and backstops. Part of the solution is finding the right message, but more important is how we give power to our words through actions tied to solutions. We must protect taxpayers, public budgets, and services by renegotiating public debt and the public's relationship with Wall Street. Renegotiating existing interest rates and debt with Wall Street would save taxpayers tens of billions. Keep millions of Americans in their homes by modifying mortgages and thereby transferring $73 billion annually from banks to people's wallets and communities. Demand that corporations invest their record profits and $1.6 trillion in cash reserves in jobs and communities, and that they pay their fair share of taxes. Step 2, create economic pressure for real change. The next step is to launch campaigns that create economic pressure on Wall Street, multinationals, and the super rich by exposing the unfairness, immorality, and fundamental unsoundness of Wall Street and corporate practices. We must expose Wall Street and the big banks through investigations, litigation, and a student loan and underwater mortgage strike. We must divest and leverage public and pension money. Wall Street and big banks make huge profits doing business with public entities and pension funds. We must bargain for local investment and Wall Street accountability through public sector unions. Conditions have never been riper for a campaign to protect and grow the middle class. Escalating actions and civil disobedience are already springing up at banks, in politicians' offices, at corporate franchises, and at home evictions around the country. Progressives need to offer an analysis that gives citizens the confidence to challenge the economic policy of Wall Street. At the same time, we need to provide an inspirational vision of the kind of society we are working to create. And we need to seriously plan how to achieve that vision by fighting for and winning transformative economic change that redistributes wealth and power. We can restore an arc of history that bends toward justice, equality, and greater opportunity for us all if we have the courage to challenge the most powerful and together take a step closer to the promised land. Otherwise, we may soon watch 100 years of victories disappear. And that was Take the Fight to the Streets by Stephen Lerner in the May issue of In These Times. This has been Michael McCusker.